This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, many credit him with reducing crime in New York City under the so-called broken windows theory of law enforcement. Returning to New York is Bill Bratton as the new commissioner of the NYPD.
He's coming to us from Los Angeles. Was it different there? He's promising it'll be different now in New York and this next time around. Let's wait and see.
We'll talk about a little-known trade agreement in the works. It's called the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Disclosures of the secret negotiations on that agreement finally made it front-page news.
We'll talk more about data privacy, reform measures, and the NSA.
Mountains of information have come out since Edward Snowden. We'll have a guest today that can help us sort through it all, or some of it.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
New York City Mayor-elect Bill de Blasio recently announced the appointment of Bill Bratton as the new commissioner of the New York City Police Department. He lauded Bratton's work in Los Angeles, saying Bratton could police fairly while still bringing down crime. During his seven-year tenure leading the LAPD, critics point to increased police presence among the homeless in and around Skid Row and excessive stops of pedestrians, especially in poorer communities. Sound familiar? Our guest, civil rights attorney Carol Sobel, says Bratton created an underclass of over-policed people. Sobel, also a member of the National Lawyers Guild, has been involved in several lawsuits against the Los Angeles Police Department. Carol, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Well, we have you on here because you're a Los Angeles Guild attorney who's had to live with Bill Bratton, the new appointment as our police commissioner by our mayor. He's been to New York before. We didn't love him then. But everybody said he sort of saw the light in his 7 years in Los Angeles. He did a great job. And so we wanted to hear from someone on the ground in Los Angeles who's a lawyer who does work with civil liberties, et cetera, about what your experience was with Bill Bratton.
Well, I actually just sent an email to my very good friend, and she is my very good friend in this, but my co-counsel, Connie Rice. And the email that I sent to Connie was that the greatest, quote, achievement of broken windows in Los Angeles was nearly $50 million spent oppressing poor people on Skid Row, which at the time that they began that program was the second safest area of the Central Division, which is all of downtown. It was not $50 million wisely spent. It was badly spent, particularly when you think the people could be out. But that was a hallmark of Bratton's work in New York, broken windows, and that's what he came to Los Angeles in part to import.
I want our listeners to understand what broken windows is and what he did exactly around it.
Broken Windows is a program that Bratton began in New York with a sociologist that he worked with who had written a piece about it. And it basically is the theory that if you stop the small, petty issues, you prevent greater crime. So if you stop somebody from littering, they're not going to shoot somebody. I think that is essentially the theory of it. In Los Angeles, I use that example because in Los Angeles, that is exactly what they started doing, arresting people on Skid Row for littering. And littering could be somebody who was smoking and the ashes fell off their cigarette. That was littering. Nowhere else in the city would you get even cited for that. But in Los Angeles, it was an arrestable offense, if not just a citation, in some instances, an arrestable offense. It resulted in, they spent nearly $50 million in this program called the Safer Cities Initiative that put 100 extra officers in Skid Row simply to cite people for that, to write tickets for violating traffic laws. More than half the time, the police were wrong because they didn't know what the traffic laws were or what applied to them. But this was where the focus was. It didn't reduce crime. It created a statistical reduction. But in Los Angeles, in Skid Row, you might have had two homicides in 1 year. And so the next year you only had one, and they called that a 50% reduction. Well, no statistician worth their salt would accept that as a statistically valid difference because it's such a small number. But for the LAPD, that was how they counted it out. That was part of their CompStat numbers, this thing that's been touted a lot about Bratton keeping officers accountable by making them report how many crimes they had of different types, part of which people have said they manipulated by reducing, by categorizing things as infractions when they used to categorize them as misdemeanors so that you didn't report them to the FBI. The whole CompStat thing is based on this scheme of Category 1 and Category 2 crimes that you report to the FBI. So that was what happened with homelessness. When Bratton first came to L.A., one of the first things he did was attack people on Skid Row. So the first thing was a program called Operation Enough, in which they had dozens of officers go out, Department of Corrections, everybody, drug-sniffing dogs, and virtually every black man who stepped out on the sidewalk that day was thrown up against the wall. And a number of them were arrested. They were supposedly looking for people who were parole violators, probation violators, and absconders, people who didn't show up on bail. We sued over that. And when we sued, we held a press conference on Skid Row. And Bratton used to do this show called Ask the Chief on the one of the radio stations. So he happened to be on that day. And they, as I was driving away, I heard him interviewed. They asked him, you know, what did he think of this lawsuit? And Bratton's response was, I beat the ACLU every time in New York, and I will beat them every time here. I'm very pleased to tell you, he never once beat us.
You sued him early and often, I understand, Carol.
I sued him early and often on Skid Row in particular. I had three different lawsuits about Skid Row. And part of what we had in Los Angeles was what is essentially stop and frisk on Skid Row. That was the lawsuit where Bratton said he beat the ACLU every time. He beat them every time in L.A., too. They used to stop every black man or anybody they thought was homeless walking down the street, and they would handcuff them, frisk them, and then let them go. If they didn't have a good ID or they had a question about their ID, they'd take them to the station and hold them there. They decided what kind of ID would be valid. We had a lot of vets on the street who only had a veteran's ID, but they didn't like that. They wanted you to have a California ID, which people couldn't afford and just didn't have. So we put an end to that. We had to go back and do it again at the end of his tenure there, because I do think that Bratton was probably good for the department at that time, and that he changed from the time that he came until he left. He changed somewhat. Maybe a little bit more recognition that humility goes a long way sometimes. But let me take you to May Day, because we had one of the biggest police assaults on a peaceful crowd on May 1st, 2007. And Bratton's first response on that was his officers were absolutely right. There were a bunch of, and this was these were his words, 100 agitator anarchists. It's said as almost as if it's one word, and that they caused the problem. This was an incident where the police went through the largest park in Los Angeles. It's a, sort of like our Central Park. It is separated by a major east-west boulevard that is about six or eight lanes across. It's 80 feet. The police started at the south corner and went all the way to the north corner. People on the north side where the demonstration was, most of it was, didn't have a clue what was going on in the south side. And they just beat people, yelled out orders. They had no one on hand who could speak Spanish. This was an immigrants' rights march. And they had helicopters. And I've listened to all the radio calls. There was no one who could give the order to disperse. So they began entering the park en masse and beating people and yelling at them to move in English about 3 minutes before there ever was an order to disperse given. With all of that, with broken bones, I mean, people were knocked off walls they were sitting on. With all of that, Bratton's first response was, my officers did everything right. And that is the wrong response. So by day two, he said, well, there were 50 anarchist agitators. And by day three, he said, there were maybe 15, and you know what? We shouldn't have handled it the way we did. And it was a learning experience. You know, but he started from that automatic response of a police chief to say, my officers did nothing wrong. Before he knew the facts, before he knew anything. I think he grew from that to the end. You know, I think more because of the international outcry at what happened on May Day in Los Angeles. And I think he was he was forced to do it. He was forced to give up his position, his entrenched position of defending his officers, and really look at this analytically. So, you know, I think that I do think that he changed somewhat while he was there. Let me add one other point. I know that in Connie Rice's editorial, she talked about how Bratton won over the black community. When May Day happened in 2007, Bratton had been there 5 years. No one in the police department knew who the leaders of the Latino community were. They asked me who they should be talking to. I said, how could that be? How could you not know who to talk to? They said, well, they change all the time. I said, no, they don't change. Shirley's been here for 20 years. All these organizations, they've been here 20, 30 years. You know, I'll tell you who to talk to, but how could you not know? But one thing I do think is fair to say about Bratton at this point is that he will take direction, which he probably didn't do before. And he will understand what de Blasio wants. So if de Blasio wants him not to do what he did before, he probably won't do it. I'm so stunned at this, the lack of a critical analysis of Bratton in his time in Los Angeles, because there were things that were not good. The racial profiling issue, they got out from under a consent decree, but they didn't really stop the racial profiling. And the differences that have come in South L.A. now, I think are more the result of the leadership of Charlie Beck than they were of Bill Bratton.
That's the new police chief, right?
Yeah, he's the new police chief. He's very different than anybody we have ever had. The best thing Bratton did while he was in Los Angeles was promote Charlie Beck rapidly from captain up to deputy chief and then chief.
One thing you said was that, and I've seen this before, is that compared to what you had in Los Angeles before, which was, you know, perhaps one of the more racist police departments in the country, that Bratton, whatever he did about, you know, in Skid Row, whatever he did on racial profiling, whatever he did on the May Day, that it was still better than you had before. So I think we're getting some reaction from that. Does that sound right?
I think that's true. I mean, we after the Rodney King uprisings, we had Willie Williams, who turned out not to be the right person for that time. And then we went back to an insider in the form of Chief Parks, who was terrible and more rigid than anybody had anticipated. And, you know, Chief Parks' view, and I like the man, but, you know, he was difficult. We were dealing on a class-wide sex harassment, sex discrimination case, and he was impossible because his view was, I lived through all this discrimination, you can do it too.
You referred to Connie Rice, and she had an op-ed in the New York Times essentially endorsing Bratton as the...
Enthusiastically.
Enthusiastically. And I'm interested in, first, who's Connie Rice, and what was your reaction to that editorial?
Well, Connie Rice is a great civil rights lawyer. She is just a visionary. She was with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, Inc. She headed the Western Regional Office for a long time. And she is just a wonderful, wonderful person, incredibly smart, and my very, very good friend. But she decided to work from the inside on a lot of these issues. And that's okay. I understand that. I think it's really important to have somebody who looks at it from the other side as well, which is sort of my role at this point. But Connie is one of the leading civil rights lawyers in Los Angeles, and she deserves all the recognition she gets. And she had a different relationship than I did. She had different access than I did. And I think that she's achieved a lot in some areas with her approach. You know, we don't agree on everything, obviously.
Carol, thank you very much.
Thanks, Carol.
Okay,
we'll follow up when the cards start being played. Bye-bye, Carol.
Thank you, Michael. Bye-bye.
Hey! Say the words to words.
Have you heard about the Trans-Pacific Partnership? If you haven't, you're not alone. We mentioned it in an update a couple of weeks ago. The TPP is an agreement to enhance trade and investments, promote innovation and economic growth among 12 Trans-Pacific countries, including the United States, Canada, Japan, Mexico, New Zealand, Australia, Brunei, Chile, Malaysia, Peru, Singapore, and Vietnam. As negotiations continue among the countries, Much of it is done in secret, including an international trade treaty that could have far-reaching effects on internet services, copyright law, and civil liberties. Last week, WikiLeaks posted texts of purported treaty drafts, as well as the negotiating positions of the various countries. This latter leak demonstrated that the United States is applying heavy pressure to get its way with the other countries. Today, we're glad to have with us George Kull, Senior Director at the Communication Workers of America, to talk about the impacts the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, could have on the economy and organized labor.
George, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Many of us had not heard of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but I understand that it has potentially large repercussions for all of us. So could you briefly describe what it is?
Sure. It masquerades as a trade deal, but it's really an economic integration agreement, which represents 40% of the world's economy. And it's a series of countries down that circle the Pacific Ocean. So it goes down the United States into Latin America, across to Vietnam, for example. And there's disparate living standards and disparate standards that are being negotiated. And what it is a secret negotiation. So unlike most negotiations where you would know what are the objectives of this trade deal, what are the objectives that our country is seeking, none of that's available. Congressmen cannot see what the text is, and yet there's 600 corporate lobbyists who get to weigh in and make suggestions to what the United States negotiating text is. So it ends up being a major economic agreement, which we'll call a trade agreement because they do, but it governs investment, it governs the rights of companies to sue corporations, it governs environmental regulations in our country, it governs health and safety regulations here, it will impact food labeling, for example. It touches all of our lives in a very significant way.
I understand that negotiators are hoping for what's called a fast-track authority, meaning that Congress will vote up or down and there won't be any possibility of changes or amendments to this. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's accurate. So there are really two separate things that impact trade negotiations. One, as you said, is fast-tracked. And fast-track was an invention by Nixon, of all people, to kind of remove from Congress the authority, which has the exclusive constitutional authority to deal with trade issues. President negotiates, but Congress gets to set the objectives. And what Fast Track does is it says that there's going to be an up or down vote on legislation that's prepared by the president, submitted to the Congress, doesn't go through channels in terms of committees, and its rules are predetermined so that there has to be a vote on it. So Fast Track authority expired last in 2007. And so what happened last week, a submission of legislation to grant the president Fast Track authority. Now, what will be doubly bizarre is that Fast Track authority actually should be done before negotiations start. And so Fast Track authority would also contain, here's some of the objectives that we think should be pursued. And in this instant case, you've got the 12 rounds, many rounds of the negotiators in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, having already taken place before they have actually even the authority or the congressional objectives of what we want this trade agreement to do for us.
George, you're with the Communications Workers of America. What interest does the CWA and its workers have in this deal that's going down?
We have a couple of interests, both broad and narrow. So let me start with the narrow interest that we had, is that we were pushing a bill which said that if you talk to a call center person, and you should know where that person works, you should be able to talk to somebody in the United States, and that your information should be protected. A bill like that could be viewed as interfering with trade, and that the TPP and the kind of trade agreements that get negotiated would supplant the ability of a country to implement language like that. So that threw up a big red flag for us in terms of a narrow interest. And then on a broader interest, we've been doing a lot of work trying to recreate democracy in our country and strive for economic justice. And in doing that, you have to work with partners. And many of our partners in the environmental community, for example, see these kinds of agreements as a disaster because they undercut environmental regulation. They undercut regulation and the ability, they depend on the ability of countries that don't have the mechanisms to enforce their existing law. And they set up situations which already exist in which companies can sue a country for having environmental protections. So right now there's $14 billion worth of suits where companies are saying that my right to gain profit was obstructed by these environmental or other kind of regulations. So that we have a kind of a broad community of people that we work with that are looking for economic justice that drives us to say that, that this process of the TPP and the company Fast Track, which will accompany it, is just wrong. Why is it that and who set it up as an objective that we want to have an agreement, a trade agreement, where we open up to Vietnam, which pays 20 cents an hour as a minimum wage, which will only drive down our wages, which still has the case that's so poor where the rural people will sell their children into city garment factories. This is Human Rights Watch does this as a report, where our Labor Department says that these kinds of violations are so horrific that they're on a do not patronize list. Our Defense Department, which is not the paragon of liberalism, says that human rights violations are so bad in Vietnam that we shouldn't be trading with them. And yet somehow that becomes a partner of TPP and can only serve to drive down U.S. wages and U.S. job creation. And so the lack of objectives, so the objectives that we would have in a trade agreement would be, how do we promote collective bargaining? How do we create growth that benefits working people? And that's not in this picture.
Another aspect in my brief reading about this that I found startling was that foreign corporations will be given equal access to bidding on U.S. federal government contracts, and they can challenge U.S. laws and regulations, including those that deal with some of the things you mentioned, health, environment, telecommunications, if they think our laws in any way limit future expected profits.
Yeah, and that's stunning, and that's true, and it's stunning that this is called the investor state chapter, that this is what our government takes a position, that this is an appropriate way to have economic growth. It makes no sense at all. So that we have, for example, cigarette labeling in this country. Well, a foreign cigarette manufacturer could say that's a violation of free trade, and in fact those regulations that we've had for a long time are an impediment to trade, and therefore I've been denied profit from that, and therefore I'm going to sue the government, and if I win, taxpayers will pay me to sell my cigarettes there. There's an example that of the export of shrimp from different countries where there's a chemical which has been known to cause blood disease. So in this country, we've banned it, chlorpheniramine, and yet in Thailand, China, Vietnam, and Ecuador, it's used as an antibiotic to control the shrimp farming. Well, in this package of negotiations, if you no longer say the shrimp is coming from someplace, you can't enforce that regulation in the United States. And the way in which then that will enter our markets is uncontrollable.
We're speaking with George Cole, the senior director at the Communications Workers of America. George, the way this seems to make sense to me is that this is kind of an organized international race to the bottom, where workers in one country are pitted against another and there's no way to regulate their health and safety or wages.
And that's unfortunately true. We've got a government which ought to be of and by the people, and instead our government is acting of and by international corporate interests and a set of strategic security interests where they would say, oh, it's important for us to have Vietnam with us. And that means that we should lower our standards and let them trade with us because that's going to lead to a better world. Well, we don't see it. And if you put that question to the American people, they don't see it either. And then all the more reason why it's then offensive that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is being negotiated in secret, and that some sections had been leaked, and those sections contain positions which make no rational sense to anybody. But why should medical procedures be copyrighted so that life-saving medical procedures are copyrighted? So if you use that procedure in a poorer country, now you got to pay somebody to do whatever the surgery would be. Or similarly, in the way in which the U.S. government is acting on behalf of drug companies to extend their profits looking forward by saying that even though there's no real change in the pharmaceutical drug, there's no real innovation there. If they change the color or the shape of the pill, for example, that would be count as a new drug, and therefore you'd extend patents that much further, which increases the cost of drugs, which are obviously essential for world health. You know, all of this is about creating a structure which lets companies maximize profit, but doesn't really deal with the issues of, you know, people, their daily lives, their work lives, and the future for our children.
George Cole, what is the Communication Workers of America doing about this, and what should our listeners do about it particularly?
Well, I think specifically where we are at right at this moment is trying to tell Congress that, listen, that NAFTA didn't work. There was a promise of 200,000 jobs. We lost 700,000 jobs. Just recently, we had a Korea trade deal. So there's a promise of 70,000 jobs, but we lost 40,000 jobs. So people need to stand up now and reach out to their congressman and say, be against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, be against TPP. We've got about 200. So in the U.S. House, there's 435 congressmen. We've got 195, nearly 200, who have come out one way or another saying that, you know, they don't like the fact that it's being done in secret, and they realize that, you know, this is creating problems for people. The most important thing is to stand up now, be it in the streets, or be it on the telephone, or be it in a letter to a congressman, to say, I want you to be against the TPP. This doesn't represent my interest. And then we will go through a dance in next year around Fast Track, which is giving authorization to the administration to govern the process. And we will be saying there, too, wait a minute, we want trade should promote our interests. Trade should promote better environment. Trade should promote better labor rights. Trade should promote rising living standards and collective bargaining. And that should be the goals that Congress is giving the administration to negotiate on.
George, I'm interested in what's happened recently around this. I know there was an extension now for another year, but partnership became... We became aware of it. I know you've been working on it for a number of years, probably. We became aware of it through the WikiLeaks disclosures. That made it a little more public, I think, for people. And one of the things that came out in those disclosures was that the U.S. was putting an incredible amount of pressure on the other countries. Do you have a comment about that? Is that consonant with what you've been seeing?
It's this bureau, this branch of our government is acting on behalf of companies and wants to secure these agreements, which benefit these companies and these negotiating agendas. The story that I got told once as a success story was that this was that, listen, that when this was during the Korea trade agreement, there was an insurance company that didn't like the fact that Korea had a law that said that you have to process insurance claims in Korea. And so they had a data processing center in the Philippines. So it became the strong opinion of the U.S. government that having data safeguards in your country was not appropriate to a free trade agreement, that you should, the data should flow across borders, all because this one insurance company didn't want to put an office in Korea and already had the operation in the Philippines. And you scratch your head and you say, why is our government acting on behalf of this company? You know, why isn't it acting on our behalf to talk about raising up our standard of living? So this branch of government, in terms of the International Trade Commission, has been captured by interests and captured by an ideology that says that we have to make these deals. I mean, they have a rap that goes with it. Free trade is a good thing. Free trade will lead to jobs. A, it's not trade anymore. It's about the rules of the economy. Two, the facts are not with them. When they do these deals, we have less jobs. And then three, to put companies above nations is kind of contrary to, you know, the American ethic.
George, this has been fascinating, disturbing, and if listeners would like to go somewhere for more information, where do you recommend?
There's two places. I would come to at www.cwa-union.org. We have it, and then you would see a TPP section. We have lots of information there.
Great.
And then the Citizens Trade Campaign is the other coalition group that we work with a lot.
Wonderful.
And I want to thank, really, you, George, for being with us, and CWA. I mean, you know, most of us just in the last few weeks have even heard of this thing, and you've obviously been at it for a while as well as CWA.
Well, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here, and let me throw out a couple of other names of our partners, the
okay.
Sierra Club and Public Citizen as well, that along with the Citizens Trade Campaign, have been laboring in these trenches for a long time.
Thank you so much, George.
Yeah, George Cole, it's just been great having you on the show. Keep up the good work.
Thank
you.
Bye-bye. Appreciate you all.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. We continue to examine ongoing developments in online privacy, corporate and government data mining and surveillance. For example, cell phone carriers answered at least 1.1 million requests from law enforcement agencies seeking information on their customers. 500 authors from around the globe recently condemned widespread state surveillance, and internet companies are banding together to call for government reforms. Joining us to talk about related laws and policies is Alan Butler, Appellate Advocacy Counsel with EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Alan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Last week we read that a technology industry is issuing a call for the government to limit surveillance of its own users. And we were interested in your response to that because some of us aren't sure how genuine this is and whether it's really a ploy to get and keep more consumers.
Well, I think that, you know, the question of whether it's genuine, I think my response to it is that it's good to have more people, you know, on our side. It's good to have support for the reforms that we've been pushing for many years now. I think that the core issues that were identified in the letter from the six companies are, you know, important issues, especially the issue of ending bulk surveillance, of increasing transparency of the intelligence process, and of improving oversight. I think those are all really important goals. Those are goals that we've advocated for in the past, and it's good to see these companies helping as well.
Okay, so you're with the Electronic Privacy Information Center, a nonprofit research and advocacy group based in D.C. Can you give us highlights of some of the other reforms that you've been calling for over the years?
Sure. So there's, you know, reforms in a number of different areas. We've been pushing for many years for additional transparency of national security and intelligence gathering. In the context of criminal investigations, for example, under the Federal Wiretap Act, there's a very good law and a very good practice of reporting aggregate information about the number of requests that are, the number of wiretaps that are conducted each year, whose information is gathered, whether that those investigations result in a conviction, what types of crimes, et cetera. There's a lot of really useful information about how that wiretap authority is used, but we don't have related information about how intelligence gathering authorities are used, even in the aggregate. And I think that that has been a hindrance over the last few decades to proper public oversight of these programs. And the other thing we've called for in the past is is better oversight, really pushing on the Intelligence and Judiciary Committees of Congress and the government as a whole to provide public accountability for these programs so that people can understand how they function and strike the proper balance. And then the other thing that we've pushed for more recently, once we learned about the bulk collection of communications metadata, is simply that that program needs to end. The bulk collection of Americans' telephone records, as we argued recently in a petition we filed before the U.S. Supreme Court, is a program that is unlawful and has to end.
Alan, what is it going to take to end that program?
Well, there's a bill in Congress right now, proposed by Senator Leahy and Representative Jim Sensenbrenner and sponsored by a number of members of Congress, that would end the bulk collection of telephone records if it were passed today. There's a competing bill introduced by Senator Feinstein and other Intelligence Committee heads that would basically enshrine the current bulk collection program in law. So that's the kind of exact opposite in terms of how the program is going to function. So there's really two competing views right now of what happens next.
Let me, a while ago, I guess at the end of the summer, there was a vote, I guess it was in the House on something. I don't know if it was on bulk data, but that came close to actually doing something.
The Amash Amendment.
Right, the Amash Amendment. Does that have anything to do with this? Is that a similar law you guys are trying to work in stopping bulk surveillance, or is it something different altogether?
So to clarify one thing, my organization doesn't lobby, right. So we don't actually support particular legislation, but the Amash Amendment, what was really interesting about that is that it was soon after the revelations of the early summer, and it was really taken at a time when, members of Congress hadn't, fully fleshed out a plan for what to do next, and yet there was still nearly enough support in that context for defunding the whole program in the House. That bill nearly passed, and I think that shows support for serious reform. It shows that Congress is taking this issue seriously, and that they want to do something. They recognize that something has to change, and there's a lot of motivation to do that.
What worries me here, and I'm just interested in your thoughts on it, I saw the Google ad or the ad by all those companies, and of course, it's better to have them say something than nothing. What worries me is that there'll be sort of, it'll look like there's reforms on the surface, and they'll do something that sort of makes the issue be less intense or go away, and yet a tremendous amount of the government surveillance will continue. I don't know how to get at that, but I don't know if that's a concern of you and your organization or how you think about that.
It's definitely a concern, and I think that's the right way to think about it. One thing I will highlight is that it's great to have these companies on board for these reforms, but at the same time, we've been pushing for a number of years for these companies to do more themselves to protect their users. That obligation doesn't go away. In terms of employing the best security, of encrypting web communications, and also of minimizing the unnecessary collection of user data, because just housing this data alone really creates the opportunity for the government intelligence gathering in the first place. But I think to address your question more directly, I think that's the right question, the right way to think about how we fix the problem going forward. And the answer has to be transparency and public oversight of the programs. We have to be able to have public trust in what the government is doing. And we simply can't do that unless we know more about what the government is doing and we have some mechanism for public accountability.
Alan, speaking of transparency, I understand that recently tech companies like Google and Apple have started publishing transparency reports on government and police requests that they've received. Have you seen any of these reports?
Sure. The transparency reports that Google and Apple have published have been some pretty impressive documents. I mean, they're releasing, they're putting forward a lot of information about the type of data that they collect on users and, the type of data that's turned over to law enforcement and otherwise. I think that they are limited by current laws in terms of what they can share about national security investigations. That's a battle that's being fought both in Congress and in the courts in terms of improving that process. I think it's better for everyone if we can have aggregate, not specific information about specific investigations, but if we can have transparency about the investigatory process and the scale of the activity and the nature of the activity.
And I understand that the policies vary from carrier to carrier, so that, for example, AT&T and T-Mobile do require warrants before a law enforcement agent can have access to someone's location data. But Verizon and Cricket just say they can't give real-time location information. So do you think there's going to be an effort to standardize policies in terms of how these carriers deal with law enforcement?
I think there does need to be some standardization, both on the part of the companies and on the part of Congress in terms of establishing those clear standards. Because currently, some of the standards for law enforcement access, in what you were referring to, for law enforcement access to user records and to user communications are unclear because of the way that the law is written and because of the way the technology has evolved. There are some severe ambiguities in that law, and we don't really have clear answers yet. So either the companies have to set, I think, national standards and best practices, or they have to do that anyway, but they not only have to set national standards and best practices, but I think we also have to establish clearly, you know, what the rules are, and we have to establish rules that recognize the sensitivity of information like location data.
So in an ideal world, if this were to happen, what about the possibility of the government entering, according to the so-called back door that I understand some technologies have? So there's a way that even if they don't have permission, they can go in and get the data themselves. Am I wrong about that?
There's a couple different pieces there. So the first issue is whether and when the intelligence community is surveilling internet communications at the physical and logical point of connection between different countries, the fiber optic cables, the backbone of the internet. So that's an issue of, you know, the government, rather than going to Google or Yahoo, is going to the owner or leaser of the fiber optic cables that carry Google and Yahoo's communications and getting those communications as they transit those networks. That's obviously something that's been happening. We've seen that in recent disclosures and news stories. It's definitely an area of concern. It's an area where, again, there need to be clear rules and there need to be adequate protections in place. We saw, for example, was released by the Director of National Intelligence a few months ago, an opinion by the Foreign Intelligence Court from October 2011 that discussed the collection of internet communications essentially in the way you're describing, upstream collection, they called it in that case. And the court found that through that collection, the NSA was actually sweeping up a significant number of communications of U.S. persons that were completely innocent and were not implicated in any investigation. And the court actually found that the NSA's procedures at that time have violated the Fourth Amendment. That creates a substantial issue, and we need to have a framework in place to make sure that that type of thing is not happening.
I have a question. We're talking about this collection of metadata, which is, you know, the information on our cell phone calls, et cetera, obviously in a mass way. And then I was intrigued by how that relates to the article that appeared a couple of days ago. Cell phone carriers last year answered at least 1.1 million requests from law enforcement agencies seeking information on caller locations, text messages, and other data. Now, that's actually when they make specific requests for cell phone tower information or other things. Is there a relation between this metadata collection and that? Is that being abused, 1.1 million requests for all this information?
I think the only real relationship between the two is that they both concern details about telephone calls. The 1.1 million requests are for law enforcement, not for national security investigations. And as you mentioned, they're collected about specific targeted individuals rather than in bulk. But I think it is an area of concern. Again, as I highlighted before, the law doesn't currently, the statutes, the federal privacy laws don't currently recognize the sensitivity of location data. I think location data is uniquely sensitive in terms of telephone records because it reveals where a person is, where they go, and really can reveal their associations and their behaviors. And it can also reveal you know, whether they're in a private place like a home. And historically, the government hasn't really been able to use technologies to invade, to cross the barrier of the home to track a person. So that is a significant issue.
We're speaking with Attorney Alan Butler of EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Alan, what kind of work are you doing right now at the office? And more generally, what kind of work is your organization doing?
Well, EPIC is a public advocacy organization, and we really seek to inform the public about current and important privacy issues. One area of our work is in the open government field. We file Freedom of Information Act requests seeking records about government programs, typically federal agencies. So we're looking at what DHS is doing and what FBI is doing, and we're using the federal open government laws to get access to information about those programs. So that's one area of our work. And in that area, for example, I recently worked on a case where we were able to get thousands of records from the FBI about a cell phone surveillance technology that they used called a Stingray, which was recently discussed in a USA Today story. The technology that could be used to track the location of cell phones or even intercept content. So that's one area of our work. Another area that I manage is we file what are called amicus briefs, or friend of the court briefs, in federal and state cases in the courts of appeals and the Supreme Courts, in cases that have important privacy issues. So when the Supreme Court hears a big case about electronic privacy, typically we're going to weigh in on that, and we're going to provide an independent expert view of the issue, and we're going to provide the court with important information about the technologies at issue or the legal implications of the case beyond, you know, the facts before the judges.
And you've also done a lot of work, haven't you, on protecting the rights of children who are so often vulnerable to data aggregators' efforts to get their private information at an early age?
That's true. We've done work along with other organizations on COPPA, which is an important federal privacy law that protects children's data. We've also been doing a lot of work recently on student privacy, which is an issue of definite concern for many millions of Americans, looking at what sort of data is collected about young students and, you know, what sort of third-party advertising models impact their lives.
Basically, my sort of view is that there's not much more that we can try and reform the system, but essentially it's so powerful right now, and the intelligence agencies are so powerful, and there's so much we may not know what they're doing, and there's so many ways to track us, that our best hope may be some form of encryption of our material, using, let's say, Tor, which disguises our IP address. They can always put bugs in your computer. But I'm just wondering how you look at those two, whether you think we can really ever make ourselves, I wouldn't say, you know, completely foolproof, because I think that's not possible, but whether people should be eventually, as we get easier methods of encryption for people that regular people like me can understand and do things, whether that isn't not a better way to go, but that a necessary way to go.
I think it's a combination of things. I'm not a fatalist on this. I don't think that the system can't change. I believe that we can build a system where we have oversight mechanisms in place that we can all trust. I don't think we're there yet. I think we have a lot of work to do, but I think that we need to get to a place where there's enough transparency and there's enough public oversight that we trust that there's not some nefarious or otherwise troublesome collection going on behind closed doors. I think we have to build that system. And then I think in addition to that, it's important to promote privacy-enhancing technologies. We have a page on our website that lists them and describes them for people who are interested in learning about them. And I think those are critically important, and I think that we need to protect those from external attack. Our organization was actually founded on the battle over strong encryption technology in the 1990s, where the NSA was trying to establish what was at the time was called the Clipper chip, which was a tool that would essentially have provided a backdoor to all strong encryption for the NSA. And that was the core fight that really spurred our organization's existence.
What's the webpage where people can go to your general site, and then I guess it'll be easy to find the site on encryption?
Sure. So our webpage is epic.org, epic.org. We have a page on privacy-enhancing technologies.
Here's my technical question, maybe overly technical for this show or for you, but you know, so I'm sitting on my computer and I have an encryption ability. I type the letter A, and that's encrypted, and it's sent out to another computer over, you know, an internet line. That person receives it, presumably also can, you know, and then his computer can or her computer can de-encrypt it. But if there's a little bug in my computer, when I type that A, the A before it's encrypted gets picked up as an A by the NSA or somebody's bug who got into my computer, and then the encryption doesn't do me any good. Is that a fantasy of mine, or what is that?
Keylogging is obviously a technology that is very powerful.
What's keylogging?
Keylogging is what you're describing. Okay. Keylogging is a piece of software that keeps a record of the keystrokes as you're typing on a keyboard. And you're correct to say that even if you encrypt your communication, there's still a threat of sort of an inside attack from within your computer. That's part of the package I was describing. I think people, as they integrate technology more into their lives, there's a necessary need to understand how that changes everybody's threat model, right? Like when we don't carry all of our data on a cell phone, our idea of, you know, what we have with us and what is at risk at any given time of either theft or of infiltration is different than when we carry a device in our pocket that has a tremendous amount of sensitive personal information in it, whether that's financial data or health data or other private communications. It changes, you know, the way we have to think about how we conduct ourselves and what we have to be conscious of and what we have to sort of protect against. And keylogging software is obviously on the list of things that could be a problem, and that, you know, may spur people to use more, be more proactive with virus scans, et cetera. I don't think it's sort of a systematic problem at this point, because that software certainly hasn't infiltrated computers on some massive scale or on any scale equivalent to the scale at which the NSA had been collecting metadata, for example. But it's something to be aware of.
Should I be concerned that one of two things happens? That one, when I go out and buy my new computer, which I'm about to do, it's got this bad stuff inside of it? Or two, somebody's going to come into my apartment and put it into my computer?
I mean, I don't think that certainly shouldn't have to be a concern for the average everyday user. That's the goal, right? And part of the problem with the NSA, you know, what's been revealed so far, and one of the reasons that the companies are getting involved at this point is because the economy is global. I mean, we buy computers and devices that are built all over the world, and so we can no longer just rely on trusting even our own government, right? We have to trust that what's being sold to us in the consumer marketplace in terms of these technologies that we use in our everyday lives are built in a verifiable way to be secure. And that's the core concern here. And that's one of the things I think that's raising the ire of the international community in the context of these NSA revelations is causing the companies great grief, because they don't want to be in a situation where people outside of the U.S. are concerned, like some people within the U.S. would be concerned about buying certain communications devices from China, that there might be spyware or some other backdoors built into their hardware. So I think that is an important consideration, and that's something that really we need to address in terms of establishing those verifiable security models and tools.
Alan, I really appreciate that. And when Michael gave you the hypothetical of either it's in the computer when he buys it or someone comes in his apartment and puts it in, there's a third one, which is that it can be done online. They can put the bug in online. Am I right?
That's correct. And the use of the evolution of these online spyware tools has been quick, and there are some powerful tools out there. Especially, you know, we learned more in recent weeks than we've known before about tools that can be installed that can activate cameras or microphones on computers without turning that light on or otherwise alerting the computer user. So that's obviously something people need to be aware of, that's a possibility. And the bottom line here is that some people will say, look, we want the NSA to be able to do XYZ because their mission is to protect the country. But when it comes to computer security, if the government can do it, that means someone else can do it. And so the importance of transparency and oversight in the computer security context, I don't think can be underscored. At the moment when we're focusing so much energy and money and resources in this country on beefing up our cybersecurity, I don't think we can turn a blind eye to vulnerabilities that are created in hardware and that the NSA may be exploiting. I think that we have to eliminate vulnerabilities, not allow them to perpetuate.
Well, Alan, this has been an incredibly interesting interview. I could go on and on. In fact, I just had to have a computer expert remove some kind of adware from my computer. But if an adware thing can get on my computer and I'm careful, that means I think spyware can get on pretty easily. But we want to keep following you. So again, say your website.
We're at epic.org, E-P-I-C.O-R-G. You can find our online guide to practical privacy tools at epic.org/privacy/tools.
Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Alan.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law & Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law & Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Crying out for justice. Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice.